Hello and welcome to Let's Pod This. My name is Andy Moore and we're back. Friends, neighbors, countrymen, thank you for allowing me to take a few weeks off to rest, to reconfigure, golly, just to catch up on the news. Listeners, you may be aware that there was a whole ass news cycle about Ryan Walters. And I had many of you reach out and urge me to do a podcast. I appreciate your diehard listening needs. But as you may have seen, that news cycle has wrapped up for the most part. I'm sure we'll talk more about it in coming weeks. But for today, we're going to talk about something I would argue more important in terms of politics, not just for Oklahoma, but for the whole country, although there is certainly an element where it intersects our work here in Oklahoma. But I'm thrilled to introduce my guest for today, my co-host for this episode, my dear friend Keith Gaddy. Some of you may know Keith from previous episodes. He is the Hoffman Chair of the American Ideal at Texas Christian University. Go Frogs. And also a Presidential Professor Emeritus of Architecture at the University of Oklahoma. Keith, welcome back.
Andy, it's great to be back here.
Man, it's been a hot summer. You live in Texas for at least part of the time, and Texas has been on the headlines recently.
Yeah, it's sort of funny. Back when we were kids, they had this thing called summer reruns that would happen on television. That's an ancient time, but one of the big things in TV has been reboots, right?
Yeah.
Redoing a thing. And Texas is having a redistricting reboot.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about gerrymandering and redistricting and what this means in terms of, I think, the opening fires, opening shots of the gerrymandering wars of what may continue for the next few years. So let's first kind of lay a landscape and then get into what's happening.
Absolutely.
I'm going to say what I think the landscape is, but please interject. President Trump basically called Texas Governor Greg Abbott and said, find me more Republican seats because Congress is very narrowly divided right now, right? Mm-hmm. And if they can find some more seats, that is to gerrymander, to redistrict Texas mid-cycle, then it makes the balance of power going into the next election next year tilt perhaps towards Republicans, making it more likely that the administration can get their agenda pushed through. Is that fair?
That is fair. That is completely fair. And the structure of this and why it matters. Congress is narrowly divided. The U.S. House is narrowly divided. The Republicans in the last election pretty much hit a ceiling on the number of seats they could win nationally. Historically, there's a thing that we call the surge slump of congressional elections, which is that the surge in a presidential year for the winning party carries them in with a large number of seats. And usually by the midterm, either the economy has gone south or otherwise the gild is off the lily for the incumbent president. There's a turnout slump and the seats go the other way. Okay.
Right.
It's been around for a very long time. A guy named Louis Bean had this thing called Bean's Count back in the 1940s where he explained this.
Is this where we get bean counters?
It could very well be. It could very well be, yes. In politics, it's always an accounting, isn't it? So historically, we've seen this. So the effort is to try and essentially inoculate against this cycle. And this means trying to find places in friendly territory where you can move the lines around on the districts and create some additional advantages to hold on to some seats, either to reinforce their safety or otherwise flip seats to your party's advantage, because you're going to lose elsewhere.
Right.
And that's what this is about. It's just about moving around. It's about moving the goalposts around on the different playing fields of 435 districts.
Right. So there's 435 districts nationwide. Mm-hmm. I think right now it's 220 are Republican, 213 are Democrat. There's two, I think, that are vacant that are presumably Democratic-leaning seats.
Yeah, and they were Democratic-leaning seats that had GOP incumbents. That's the interesting thing.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah. So there's a real vulnerability there for the GOP.
And so, theoretically, right, with a Republican majority, the Republicans can pass whatever they want. But even 220 people is a lot of folks to manage, and not everyone is always aligned, or they want to try to make a deal for something that's beneficial for their district. And so you get some folks who will defect either in principle or to gain something. And I think the president would like to kind of eliminate that, or at least like give extra cushion there.
Yeah, and that's a perfectly rational thing to do. Any incumbent wants to have some pad, in part because from time to time, and a speaker likes to have some pad because from time to time, you need to let your people go off the reservation, as it were, to go off the ranch.
Right.
And you don't need everybody voting the same way all the time. Sometimes you have to vote the constituency or some particular constituency need ahead of party. And it makes your majority more secure in the long run if you've got a little bit of pad.
Yeah.
And the GOP's had a hard time getting any pad because when the Democrats get control, they're usually sitting about 245 seats over the last several years.
Like a bigger majority,
yeah,
right?
They have this a bigger majority, but there are more but then when they lose control, they'll lose like 60 seats at the midterm. So they're riding more of a roller coaster than the Republicans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this kind of current environment, the president called Governor Abbott, said, "Greg, find me some more seats." Mm-hmm. And Greg said, "You got it, sir. Like, mm-hmm. you say jump, I'll say how high."
Yeah.
But not all of the Texas Republicans who are in Congress or even the legislature were like immediately on board, right? There was some consternation there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in part, presidents historically don't interfere this way. FDR used to do this kind of stuff. He would interfere in Democratic Party primaries in states, especially where Senate Democrats had not been going along with him on the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he would back candidates, usually unsuccessfully, so he learned how to step back from that a bit.
Hmm.
So it's a bit unusual to have a president that's visibly, actively engaged in this effort. But there's a good there are good reasons to do this in Texas, and some of them are legal, constitutional. Some of them are practical. Texas is a great, big, huge, enormous state. That's without exaggeration.
How many congressional seats are in Texas?
My gosh, I think they've 30? Got 38, I think.
Okay.
And they'll probably go to 42 or 43 after the next reapportionment. The Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex is the fastest growing urban part of the United States.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. It's physically bigger than Connecticut and has something like 35% of the state of Texas population in it.
That's just wild.
It's enormous.
Well,
yeah.
My parents used to live down there in Carrollton, just north mm-hmm. of Dallas. And at the time, this is 15 years ago, it was the fastest growing county in the country then. And it's mm-hmm. kept pace for a long time.
Denton County has over 1 million people.
That's crazy.
City of Fort Worth, where I live most of the time now, City of Fort Worth is the 10th largest city in the United States by itself.
Mm.
5 of the 10 largest cities in the U.S. are in Texas.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So this makes sense that the president is kind of targeting Texas. And mm-hmm. in response to Trump's ask there, and Governor Abbott, I mean, he put the screws to the legislature, called them in for special session, said, mm-hmm. you guys got to redraw the maps.
Yeah.
Mid-cycle, which is unusual. We'll talk about that in a second.
Right.
And so in response, Governor Newsom in California has said, hang on, well, if you're going to gerrymander for Republicans, then we'll gerrymander for Democrats to mm-hmm. balance it out. Now, there's a fly in the ointment in California that kind of ties their hands a little bit, I think, because the state has an independent commission.
Yes. And they also have a thing called the California Voting Rights Act.
Mm.
And these two things taken together, the commission has a variety of criteria that it has to balance. The good news for progressives in California is the nature of the California elections with the two-tier open primary system makes it mighty hard for Republicans to win many seats because it's very easy to get a good competitive Democrat in most districts.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is the California Voting Rights Act has a variety of protections in place for minority access and minority voting, which used to exist in the Federal Voting Rights Act and don't anymore.
Right.
And once we get done with the litigation in Louisiana, and in a year from now, when the Voting Rights Act probably doesn't apply to redistricting, will become more important for voting rights in states that have these types of acts. You'll be relying on the state constitution rather than the federal form of the 14th and 15th Amendment through legislation to guarantee minority voter access in redistricting.
Yeah. So taking all this together, how many seats are we talking about? If Texas has 38-ish congressional seats now, from what I've read, it sounds like they think they could get 5, maybe 10 of those to be more likely Republican, or at least like susceptible, but it's not a guarantee, right?
The effective ceiling is probably 5. They've talked about as many as 7. But in order to understand this, we ought to maybe define a couple of terms.
Yeah.
And And we'll start with gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is to draw a political line, is to draw legislative boundaries for political advantage. It can take place in the context of race. It can take place in the context of party. It can even be a gerrymander designed to protect incumbents in general. So it can be bipartisan. It can be to the advantage of one party. It used to be before we had one person, one vote guarantees. You could also gerrymander districts to ensure the primacy of rural areas over urban areas by really, really overpacking the population in urban areas. There used to be a congressional district in Harris County, Texas, that was six times as large as the smallest district by population in Texas, okay? And this was part of the foundation of the changes that came in a case called Westbury versus Sanders back in 1963, which was a Georgia case, but it affected the whole nation. Mm-hmm. So when you draw let me go ahead and put this pin out there because you and I have this experience in work. The biggest problem is single-member districts. We'll come back to that later.
Yeah.
We're operating in that context effectively. With single-member districts, there are things you have to do in Congress. You have to equalize the population based upon the last census. And this is a legal fiction because the numbers from April of 2000 are 5 years old now. We're halfway through the cycle.
Right.
Lots of growth, lots of movement. But we're going to work under the fiction that the populations are what they were in April of 2000.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are they just going to use the last census to do this? They're not going to use like a American Community Survey mid-cycle estimate, right?
This is what's fun and funny is historically, the advocates for using the ACS adjustments have been progressives, right? In part to deal with things like the undercounting of homeless populations, right? And the Republicans have a long track record and conservatives have a long track record of pushing back against the ACS and even the federal courts.
Right.
You know, it's permissible to do a variety of things which will lead to litigation. You could adjust based upon the ACS and then you'd have to defend it and you might win or you might lose. The good news is that originalist arguments that are made in front of the Supreme Court only matter when the conservatives on the court want the originalist argument to get the outcome they want. Okay, there's a wonderful literature on this. I was talking with Judge Robert Henry the other day and he put me onto a book about this, which I read while I was on vacation. And, you know, originalism is like biblical literalism.
Right.
You know, it's important when you need it to be important. Otherwise, you need that book to say what you want it to say.
Right.
And that's neither to criticize originalists nor literalists, but it is empirically true. Okay, if not literally true.
Right.
So you've got this issue of the legal fiction of equal population. You could also adjust those numbers based on citizenship population. There's an argument that can be made that the districts should be drawn on the basis of citizenship rather than general population, which in Texas has real consequences for the populations inside districts if you apportion based upon citizenship.
Yeah, so that's a slippery slope, right? So like right now we draw districts based on the total number of people in that district, men, women, children, citizenship aside.
And the Constitution literally, definitively, and originally says persons.
Right.
So we're going to find out
what makes a person, because the Constitution also said to count slaves as 3/5 a person.
Right, which was used as the argument for the basis of statistical adjustment, actually. But there is the 13th Amendment.
Right.
And the 14th Amendment, which first of all emancipated, or didn't emancipate, it outlawed, right? And it conferred. It acknowledged and extended citizenship, right? This gets to a whole other issue. This conversation for another time, which is, do African Americans in the U.S. in particular exist under what's called a constitutional social subcontract? Hmm. And there's a large body of scholarship that came originally out of black legal scholars that engages this issue. And it's a very difficult – it's an emotionally difficult literature to read because it points out a conceptual vulnerability to even black citizenship under the 14th Amendment.
Hmm.
And – the extent to which full citizenship is conferred. I don't agree with the argument because it's a frightening argument.
Yeah.
But it's one that's stuff we used to never imagine has become part of our daily discourse. This one's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah.
We'll put a pin in that and deal with the current horror. We'll come back to that if and when that becomes front and center.
Yeah. So, so you equalize population. Districts have to be contiguous. And if you have voting rights concerns under the 14th Amendment as articulated under what's called Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that it has been established in court that there's a need to craft what are called remedies based upon historic discrimination and inability to participate for minority groups, that you've created what are called remedies, which means districts that allow that group to have an equal opportunity to participate. Mm-hmm. You have to maintain those remedies. So the Texas map definitely maintains remedies for African-American majority districts and even bolsters a couple of districts in terms of the power of the remedy. Okay. It pulls down the vote, the Democratic vote, in a couple of Hispanic congressional districts, but they still have what's called the equal opportunity to elect,
okay,
which is the legal requirement for a remedy district, is the minority group should have an equal opportunity to elect, which we could think of as being a coin flip's chance. Others might argue it must be a certainty, but somewhere in between those two.
More than zero.
More than 0.5, but you don't have to be at one.
Right.
Right. But more than 0.5, better than a 1 in 2 chance. So the Texas map generally does this, but what it has also done is there were a variety of districts. This map was originally created by a federal court, and there were coalitional opportunities that were written into the map. A coalitional district is a district that contains a different mixture of African-American, Hispanic, Asian-American, and even multi-race or multi-ethnic individuals, mm-hmm, who taken together collectively constitute a majority, okay, coalitional districts. These were originally advocated in advance originally by Democrats in the state of Georgia in a map in 2001. That map was later on redone by the state of Georgia mid-decade. And then those opportunities have been eliminated, but it led to a case called called the Ashcroft case in Georgia, Georgia v. Ashcroft, where the Supreme Court, in an opinion from Sandra Day O'Connor, confirmed that you could use coalitional opportunities to satisfy the Voting Rights Act or majority opportunities, which freaked out the GOP because they want to pack as many minority voters into few districts as possible at the highest percentages available in order to ensure a variety of predominantly white electoral opportunities for the GOP. Okay. So when Congress renewed the Voting Rights Act, they indicated in their language that only majority-minority districts could be deemed to be solutions, mm-hmm, or remedies. But then when the judges did this map in Texas a few years back because the legislature couldn't come to a map, they put coalitional districts in, coalitional remedies. So coalitional remedies are good until they're bad.
Right.
And they're permissible until they're not.
Right.
But what this map does is it does exactly the same thing that happened to the Texas Democrats in 2003 and 2004. And if you go in the Wayback Machine, you might remember this. So let's take a trip to Ardmore, Oklahoma.
I was going to say, let's let me go back,
yeah,
just to like think about what's happening in 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. So that's pre-Obama. So this is pre-Andy paying attention to politics. Like, okay. I'm in college, right? We're
right.
Post 9/11. Mm-hmm. Bush is in the White House. I have no idea what the balance of power was in Congress.
Very narrow.
Very narrow back then.
And the Senate was 1-seat majority.
Okay. So pretty similar to how it is now. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Tom DeLay is the majority leader of the U.S. House from Texas.
Okay.
Yeah. And Texas, their congressional district map had been drawn by a federal court because there was split control of the Texas legislature in 2002. And then in the 2002 election, the Republicans won united control of government, and a guy named Rick Perry was governor.
Right.
You remember him.
Oh, yes.
He had 3 reasons to run for president. He could remember 2 of them. Or 3 agencies he was going to eliminate, could remember 2 of them. The one he forgot, he ended up heading,
right,
the Secretary of Energy, right?
That's right.
I actually like Rick Perry. I actually think Rick Perry was a good executive. I'm unusual among people that are left to center. And you know me, I hang on to center with a leftward lean.
Right.
And that's about it. But I actually liked Rick Perry. I thought Rick Perry was actually a very reasonable executive. He liked to get things done.
Well, that made him a terrible politician then.
Yep. Yeah, he only spent 14 years as governor of Texas. Just awful.
Right.
Yeah, but so anyhow, well, what happens is we have to go back actually to 1992. In 1992, there's a congressional election under a new map.
Right.
It's been crafted by a Democratic lawmaker named Martin Frost. Okay. And that district, even though the congressional vote that year for the Republicans was 51.1% for Congress in Texas, Republicans won, I believe it is, 8 or 10 of 32 districts in the state of Texas.
Hmm. So even though the division of partisanship was much more even, it was
dead even, yeah. Huge Democratic advantage because the Democrats had crafted a very, very creative map. So when a court goes to fix a congressional map, they only have a charge to fix whatever defects are in the map under the law.
Right.
So in 2001, 2002, split government in Texas, they can't come to a deal on a congressional map. State legislative map, yeah, they're able to come to a deal for. Well, what happens is a commission, a so-called commission, crafts the maps dominated by Republicans. It becomes the map. But the congressional map, there's no agreement between Governor Perry and the House and the Senate. So it goes to federal court. And a three-judge panel, even though they have had point, I was actually a consultant for the Texas Republican congressional delegation on mm-hmm. that one. I was their voting rights and their digital measures guy,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because, you know, money, right?
Right.
You know, money it spends. And you know, I'm sitting there going, my gosh, I have kids I'm going to send to college in a few years. We might want to cash a check or two, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. So,
and you presumably have a chance to like be a voice of reason into an unreasonable situation.
Well, and that was when I went in, I was fresh and I carved out this space as an advocate for fair elections, good government principles. And I stuck by it and I always stuck with it. And that's why I quit also is there was no opportunity left.
Sure.
So, you know, a dozen years ago, I hung it up. But what happens is we get in the door and the judges find the arguments for the unfairness in the existing map compelling. They've got no basis to fix them. What they do need to do is they need to make sure that all the districts have equal population. Okay, so they've got to draw 32 districts. It was 8 out of 30 coming, 8 out of 30 after 92. Coming into the election, it's in 2000, Republicans won 13 of 30 seats in Texas, despite winning 56% of the congressional vote in the state. So 56% of the vote is giving them 44% of the seats. Okay. So the judges draw a new map. They add two districts where there is population growth. They draw in the majority-minority opportunities. And then the rest of the map they draw with as little disruption as possible, equalizing population.
From the previous map.
From the previous map. And this allows the Democrats to win 17 of 32 and Republicans win 15 of 32 seats. Okay. So the Republicans gain, but they're still getting 56% of the vote. They're getting 40-something percent of the seats. Now, Congressman DeLay doesn't like this. He's got a narrow majority in the House. And so in 2003, summer of 2003, they come into special session. And they're going to draw a legislative map, a congressional map. And the State House Democrats say, basically, the hell you say. And so the Democratic leader disappears on his jet, which is actually tracked by Homeland Security.
Right.
Yeah. And a group of other Democrats, 50-odd of them, hop on a bus and go to Ardmore and go to the old Holiday Inn, which has been torn down and replaced right behind the Denny's, which is no longer there either, right?
Right.
Which was probably next to where the Sears used to be.
Right.
Okay, you know, so just ride this thing into the ground. And what happened, the reason they did this is in Texas, there's a provision that you have to have quorum to do business.
Mm-hmm.
And quorum is two-thirds.
And, oof, that's a steep, and even steep
if,
quorum.
Yeah, and even if you've come into session, they have a thing called a blocker bill. And what this means is there's always a bill that's kind of a nonsensical bill that's always H1 or SB1. It's at the top of the calendar. To take legislation up out of order in the Texas legislature, you have to suspend the rules. That takes a two-thirds vote.
Mm.
Well, if you don't have two-thirds of the members present, you're not going to get the two-thirds vote to suspend the rules in order to do business.
Mm-hmm.
So they hid out up there until the call for the special session expired. Then Governor Perry called another special session, and this time it was the Senate's turn. Now, of course, the Senate caucus was smaller. So they all hopped on a corporate jet and went to New Mexico where there was a really good casino.
Sure.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. It was easier crew to move.
How long were they gone, each of those? Do you have any idea?
Oh, over a month. I mean, they were tucked in and they were doing business. They were holding committee meetings and hearings and dealing with constituency service. They were doing every part of the job except showing up on the floor voting. And at the time, the Speaker of the House, Tom Craddock, issued a legislative warrant for the lawmakers to return.
Does that carry the same force of law as a bench warrant from a judge?
No. And they discovered this the hard way, because this is part of why the Democrats fled to Oklahoma, where we had a Democratic governor and a Democratic attorney general. So Brad Henry and Drew Edmondson are
right.
the players. And New Mexico is the same way. They've got a Democratic governor and they've got a Democratic attorney general. So any extradition request, you know, you have extradition agreements with other states, right? As a when I heard about this, I had a call from an attorney in Texas who I'd worked with previously. He said, yeah, the speaker is going to be issuing a warrant, and we're going to ask Oklahoma to act on the extradition agreement, compel these lawmakers to come back. And what happens is, so I hopped on the phone. I called Drew Edmondson's office. I left Drew a message. And then I got a call back. No. It was called Governor Henry's office, right? I talked to Luke at Governor Henry's office. And he calls me back and says, Keith, yeah, we called the Attorney General's office. And it turns out the Oklahoma extradition agreement only covers judicial bench warrants. Mm. It does not cover legislative warrants.
Right.
So Texas can go pound sand.
Right. Well, and I would almost imagine that, you know, there's another world where they say, yeah, okay, we'll go look for him. And then they're like, well, we can't find him. We knocked on the door and no one answered. And they just like let it go over, right?
Yeah. So, you know, but this kind of stuff's going on. Tom DeLay is asking DHS and TSA and even Department of Defense to try and find the Democrats. So the great cartoonist Ben Sargent down in Austin at the Austin American Statesman does this cartoon that shows a giant aircraft carrier in the middle of the Red River with a lookout
right.
for Democratic lawmakers on the lam going to Oklahoma.
Right.
Does any of this sound familiar?
Yeah. So I had on my notes, right? Like yeah. that's where we're at right now, right?
Yeah.
Democratic lawmakers in Texas left the state last week, I guess.
Yeah.
It's been, I don't know how many days it's been now. A couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah, and they're in Boston.
Right. They're in Boston. And Governor Abbott has said he's going to call the other governors and try to use the extradition agreement to get them back.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like any media outlet believes that's going to happen.
Yeah, they may as well just send a copy of Please Come to Boston by David Allen Coe, be done with it, okay? It just, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, the Democrats are calling it what it is.
Right.
And they're speaking to it just as they did 20 years ago. Why would we come back to do our duty to vote ourselves out of existence?
Right.
And there's a history of this kind of thing in America in general of strong arm governors and using authority to force lawmakers to come in and work. Huey Long used to do this in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. He would send the state highway patrol out to find lawmakers trying to break quorum and forcibly compel them to come back to Baton Rouge mm-hmm. to participate in the legislature so that they could pass all of his all of his share of the wealth legislation that he was pushing for, right?
Right.
So there's nothing new to these tactics, and these tactics have been used by progressives like Long. They've been used by conservatives. Gerrymandering is in the hands of both parties, but this is not an equivocation argument I'm about to make.
Sure.
The Republicans do it more because they've had more opportunities. The Republicans also have more need for it.
Yeah. Yes, on both counts. Mm-hmm. And I think if we stay on this way back machine, but keep going mm-hmm. a few more years, we get to 2010 census, mm-hmm. then 2011 is the next redistricting cycle, right?
Yep.
The next year. Mm-hmm. And that's the year that the Republicans ran the Red Map program, right? Where they they focused on, there's a great documentary about this called Slay the Dragon. Mm-hmm. You can watch it on Amazon and other things. And we'll be doing a screening of it in a coming month. I'll get back to you on that, listeners. But the focus of that was to gerrymander state legislatures in mm-hmm. particular.
Yes.
Congress where they can, but it was way cheaper to win state legislative races so that those legislatures, who are the ones drawing the maps, can then gerrymander their own districts and the congressional map.
Exactly.
And so it was a way for the Republicans, who didn't have a majority at the time, to like rewrite the rules.
Yeah.
To give them a majority.
Well, and you know, the funny thing about that is I was involved in a lot of states in that remap. And I actually ended up withdrawing from a lot of work because a map would get done and say, I can't testify to this damn thing.
Right.
And so the number of states where I got withdrawn is really something. got paid. Didn't want to, but it's like, you must take our money. Fine, I will take your money for not working. It's my pleasure.
Right.
So the place where this it's interesting is, you know, the poster child for all things gerrymandering is Wisconsin, where I was involved. I created a variety of measures and techniques that were well established for understanding maps. And in particular, I advised them on their voting rights solutions, which were the one credible parts of the map in Wisconsin. Everything else was just, man, it was something. Mm-hmm. It's the most efficient allocation of votes I've ever seen for one party. Brilliant. In the worst way, just a brilliant gerrymander. In Wisconsin, the reason they retained me instead of somebody else, they put me on retainer in 2009 going in.
Before the census?
Before the census. And then in 2010, when the census came out, we were playing with maps. I never actually designed a map, but I watched. And then in 2011, we get into it. One of the map makers told me, I won't say which one it was, he says, you know, Keith, we retained you because we thought we'd have to go back to federal court again like we did 10 years ago where you made that eloquent argument for fair maps. And we thought we were going to need that again. We didn't think that Scott Walker could win. Even we were surprised when Walker won. So they were expecting a divided government situation in Wisconsin where they had the legislature but not the governorship.
But end up they swept everything, so they didn't really need you then.
Man, it was like the dog that caught the car, right? And meanwhile, I'm standing here going, well, here's how you measure stuff. Wow, look, you got a 99.6% chance of winning a majority under every map you've drawn.
That's crazy.
Mazel tov. Well done, and that was also the beginning of the end for me personally, but this isn't about me. What happened is Red Map represented a shift in the philosophy of the GOP in redistricting. Until about 2008, the philosophy had been fair maps, fair competitive maps, we can win. That's what Republican lawyers would tell you. If we can just get a fair map and get a responsive map, we can do the rest with mobilization, right?
Which is what I think most voters expect, right? So let's pull back from the red and blue battle here, right? Most voters, if they know anything about districts, and they probably don't because most folks don't sit around thinking about this the way you and I do and probably our listeners. But most voters think every district is like fair-ish and, you know, may the best candidate win, you file, and then you've got to campaign and convince voters and win. But that is not remotely the case. And so the idea that like on a competitive playing field, then the best candidate, the most popular candidate wins is noble and wrong.
Well, and, you know, since, you know, we're in Oklahoma City today, and since we are now the basketball capital of the world, a phrase you never expected to hear uttered in the history of humanity, Oklahoma City, basketball capital of the world.
Right.
So congratulations to the Thunder. This is the difference between winning the NBA championship through a competitive 84-game season and a playoff versus watching the Harlem Globetrotters play the Washington Generals.
Right.
No one goes to the Globetrotters expecting to see them lose.
Right.
Yeah. Because the game is rigged.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's it's so funny you made that analogy. Yesterday I was talking to somebody about this, and I talked about not just this gerrymandering situation, but politics today is that we all know it's not like an NBA game with referees and it's like well controlled. It's politics is generally more like street ball. Mm-hmm. Where you all know the rules. We all know there's going to be some fouls.
Yeah.
But no one really calls the fouls because it goes both ways. And we're like, you know, we can all be reasonably rough, but fine. But then enter, like, I don't know, you know, President Trump or some bad actor. And they just come in the court and start punching people in the face.
Yeah.
Well, now everyone's like, well, how do we handle this? Like, you can't punch people. He's like, well, watch me. And he just keeps punching people.
It's not even a discreet elbow or a kidney shot, right?
Just right in the face.
Yeah.
And so at first, both teams are like, hey, that's probably not okay. Like, please don't.
Yeah.
And they just keep doing it. And eventually the team that he's playing with is like, well, I guess we can punch people now.
Well, and they can also put 9 people on the field while we have 5.
Right.
Right.
And I think right now, I mean, with this, you know, conversation with like Governor Newsom in California saying, well, if you're going to punch, we're going to punch.
Yeah.
That's... And And for all of us that are in the stands, we're like, this is not the game, the game we want to watch.
Well, and you know, this brings up an interesting point. And real quick, just to put a bow on Texas, all these things are happening again, right? All the arguments are the same arguments that existed. But the difference is when the map goes through, it's a lot easier to defend than the previous map because the voting rights regime is weakened. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that another time and dig into that because it's going to get much weaker after the Louisiana v. Calais case runs. I'm anticipating the outcome of that case and already starting a book. I've done two books on the Voting Rights Act with my colleague Chuck Bullock and my colleague Justin Wirt. We're anticipating what's happening next. We're already outlining it.
Yeah.
So we're going to – this is going to be – this will be the end of our trilogy. But unlike with Tolkien, Mordor will probably win.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So that's the only difference. The Dark Tower is probably going to prevail. Boy, man, we got this geek thing going.
We
good,
do.
Don't
yeah,
we?
That's yeah. what our listeners expect. Yeah.
Well, this is – I'm happy to be here as my true self. This is good to know. It's – but let's go to California real quick,
yep.
or any progressive state.
Okay? Yeah, there's, and I mean, some of our listeners may remember that you know I ran a ballot initiative campaign in 2019 and 2020, to create an independent redistricting commission for Oklahoma.
Yes.
And COVID happened, so we couldn't collect signatures, and we're still working on it. But there are a number of states: Michigan, California, Arizona. Theirs is different. And a few others that that use commissions.
Yeah.
There were
Did you get Arizona in there?
Yeah, Arizona.
Yeah, that's
theirs
right.
is
yeah.
not a model, but it is a commission.
It's pretty good. I mean, you know, the basic concept works.
Right. Unless you're the independent who has to chair the commission.
Yes.
Then your life is miserable.
You know, when Sandy O'Connor retired, we should have just told her you're gonna draw the districts for the nation. And she probably would have done okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She,
yeah.
Give
her something to do in retirement.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'd like to believe I could be a benevolent dictator as well. But
well, we're trying a non-benevolent one, so we'll see how a benevolent one could do.
That's right.
Yeah.
So California, go ahead.
Yeah, well, progressive states in general. You've got at least two Democratic states where the map has been engineered to an extreme Democratic advantage. One is Illinois, the other one's Maryland. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Maryland map is the least compact, ugliest thing you've ever seen and has been for three decades.
Is that just because Maryland is a weird-shaped state?
You'd think so, but when you look inside of it and you look with care because probably the best district is that Panhandle district because you can't mess with it.
Right.
It's just out there, out near Frederick, right? No, they do things where they are running islands. They connect together islands that go through one district that crosses a channel. A couple of times they cross the channel to go over to the Delmarva, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are uncompact. Sometimes you're going across an estuary. They've got the lowest compactness scores possible, not because of the shape of Maryland itself, but because of the way they turned it into a jigsaw puzzle on the inside.
Right.
It's really just a – there's a place where four districts all cross each other below Baltimore.
Right.
And it's always been that way. They tried to retain me in 2012, and I think it was just so they could say they interviewed a good government guy. So I flew into Annapolis, checked out the Capitol, sat down with them, looked at their map, and I said, this is very interesting. And then I went back to the airport in Baltimore and flew home and did not get the contract. But I got $5,000 for my time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, you know,
and a nice trip to the East Coast.
Yeah, a nice trip to the East Coast. Man, had some good crab. You know, it was a good trip.
I mean,
it's, there's no such thing as a bad trip to Annapolis, Maryland.
All right.
Yeah.
But short of having like Oklahoma where we're landlocked and we use roads and maybe creeks to for some of those boundaries, they're just out in the middle of the ocean driving them around and it gets a little willy-nilly.
It does. And so you'd have districts that are crossing the water in two different directions, right?
Right.
So it's sort of like what they did in North Carolina with what was called touch point contiguity, where they'd use a four-square intersection and have districts on either part of the checkerboard.
Right.
Yeah. But that's part of the problem is that a lot of places – there are a couple of places where Democrats have already maximized. There's just no room. The other problem is that often you either have a commission or a state constitutional provision or a state law provision that gets in the way.
Right.
Such as a prohibition against mid-decade redistricting except to deal with a defect identified by the courts.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like normally states aren't redrawn districts in the middle of a decade like this unless there's a problem.
Yeah, it's exceedingly rare.
Yeah.
Exceedingly rare. And the argument that Texas could plausibly make in both the last round and this round is, well, we're dealing with a map that was given to us by a federal court. we'd like to have the chance as a legislature to articulate a remedy to the same problem. Hmm. That's what they argued in 0304, and it was an effective argument.
This feels like when I try to negotiate with my kids, and they're like, hang on, like, but what if we say something? You're like, no, this is how it's going to be. And they're like, but I've got an idea.
Yes. Well, you know, as I used to tell, I didn't never had to say this to my kids, but I used to tell my students, I said, you know, I teach democracy and we have free speech in my classroom, but we don't have democracy in my classroom, okay? You know, I will be caught in the balls and strikes myself. But yeah, it's kind of like that. Yeah. It's everybody wants to see just how clever they can be.
Yeah.
And we are in the midst of a lot of clevering in American politics.
Mm. Or at least people who think they're clever, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, let's go ahead and get this out of our system real quick. If Ryan Walters falls in the woods, is there still porn on the television? Okay. I don't know. Sorry.
No, that's good.
You can edit that out if you want.
We have to laugh about these things because we're tired of crying.
Thank you, Mr. Lincoln. Yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned single member districts, and I want to come back to that in just a second. But first, we said that in Texas, the Republicans might be able to get 5, maybe 7 extra seats, congressional seats out of this.
Yeah.
California or other states are like starting to kind of chime in saying, well, we can gerrymander an equal number to keep the balance of power roughly where it is now.
Yeah.
But as you said at the top of the show, we're entering, you know, the midterm election cycle. And typically, there's a substantial swing away from the president's party. Not every time, but sometimes it's a big wave election one way or the other. And given the relative unpopularity of a number of the administration's policies, the dissatisfaction with Congress as a whole, certainly Democrats are hoping that this year is going to be a wave in their favor, in which case that wave could be, I think on average, it's like 24 to 30 seats.
Yeah.
So even if Republicans are successful and they squeak out 7 seats in Texas and a couple in Indiana or wherever else, there's still a chance, right, that like voters could overwhelm that gerrymander in the opposite direction. And because those seats aren't necessarily assured. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, it's completely fair. You know, there are other forces at work. And this gets to a PR issue. I mean, we're in a deeply polarized environment, but there's a lot of exhaustion. And actually, the other thing is kitchen table economics are not good right now.
Yeah.
I mean, kitchen table economics right now are worse than they were in Biden's worst year, right? The inflation is hidden, but it's absolutely there. It's absolutely there.
Yeah. I mean, every news story about tariffs is like another ding on the president's policies.
Yeah. And there's a certain exhaustion with the chaotic environment. So the question is, why, if you've got a good chance of having a really strong wave where you can prevail, why would you muddy the waters by taking a step down to lowest common denominator and having people potentially sour on turning out for you because they perceive all you've tried to do is rig the game too? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always contended the best way to win any game is playing on the other guy's field with his ball by his rules. If you can beat that guy with the ball on his field by his rules, you have absolutely won.
Right.
Won. And that's a big part of this is winning under circumstances where there is complete and undeniable legitimacy. It matters.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about the Trump election in 2024. It's the only election he's run for president where across the board, everybody can say, yeah, this is a legitimate outcome.
Right.
You know, it was a perfectly ordinary bad economy reelection for a president. This is about what a forecast model would have told you anyway. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, we have problems with polling data and other data and modelings and, you know, the problem with people juicing models and juicing turnout, try and get to the thing they want rather than the thing that's probably going to happen. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the data are less reliable. We're into a period where we need new forms of estimation to understand public sentiment. Mm-hmm. But we also have to remember the real purpose of a poll is to help you understand the basis behind a vote rather than the amount of that vote.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about polling real quick.
Sure.
As a bit of an aside, because we're about to gear up and have a whole lot of polls mm-hmm. coming out, right?
Yeah.
State and national polls. And after the last few elections, you know, since 2016, my wife does not trust polls. And also, I'm not allowed to utter the name of Nate Silver in our home because she was so devastated.
You know, Nate's dad's a friend of mine, Brian.
Oh, is he really?
He's a professor emeritus at Michigan State University. Nate Silver learned how to do multiple regression when he was 9.
Yeah. He seems like that kind of kid.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 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 Well, anyhow, it's...
but
sorry about that.
No, yeah. No, that's fine. I am still a regular listener to the Silver Bulletin, Nate's new podcast and Substack, I guess. But polling in general, right, has gotten harder. It's harder to do. It's harder for pollsters to do good work because Americans don't answer the phone the way we used to. We don't respond to those text polls. Like we're more divided in some way. So I think the math is like simpler on one hand and then much more complex on another.
Yeah.
As from you, as a expert in, you know, political science and kind of all of this stuff, what's your guidance or advice to regular folks as we start seeing polls come out? How do we think about them? Should we listen to them? Should we ignore them? What do we do?
Don't pay attention to horse race polls because there are so many issues. Like you said, there are response bias issues, right? Conservatives and low information voters are less likely to respond to a poll. And these are the two foundations of the GOP vote, which means we're left to guess how much we're underestimating it, right? You know, landlines have been unreliable for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a whole side story about getting blindsided by that when I was still in polling research 15 years ago on live television. cell phones, for a while we couldn't call into them without steep cost. Now people generally screen out of a cell phone. If you don't know the number, you're not going to answer it. Text messages can kind of get you there. Email can kind of get you there. But now you're trying to figure out what the formula is of blending all these sources of information. Mm-hmm. Are you really getting the person you're trying to contact? You dare not go to somebody's door to ask a question.
Right.
Even at the moment that we are the most publicly expressive human beings in the history of the planet through social media, we are the most private in guarding our perimeter about how we engage in it, which is we don't open the door for people, right? We don't open the door. So part of the trick for opinion research in the future, rather than calling it polling, opinion research in the future is ascertaining information about sentiment, doing sentiment analysis without relying solely upon asking questions in surveys.
Yeah.
So this means analysis of other sources of content, social media, getting an understanding of what good, reliable, representative content is, figuring out how to model it, and then figuring out a way to get predictive validity out of it, right? You know, so when we predict, we're trying to guess the future. Validity means that what happens in the future generally corresponds to our guess, okay? You want polls to have – you want any technique to have two qualities. You want it to be reliable and you want it to be valid. Valid means that it shows you what's actually happening. Reliable means that every time you do it, it gives you a valid result, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you need these two things. You can reliably get a bad result. You can, through an unreliable technique, actually get a valid result. Preferably, you get both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Something
you said in there made me think. And now I've totally lost it.
Well, you know, Andy, it occurred to me, you and I got talking really fast. Let's slow it down a minute so everybody else's ears can calm down. Let's see if we can't exercise this thought from your mind.
It'll come back to me, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It was about polling and about... I think horse race polling being like between candidates different than like public sentiment about what's happening. Oh,
yeah.
It was about AI. That's what it was.
Yeah.
So there's somebody, and I forget who it is now. I think I heard him on probably Nate's podcast or on Galen Druk, who used to be the host of the 538 Politics podcast.
Yeah.
Has his own called GD Politics. It's also very good, listeners, if you're into more political podcasts. But there's some pollster, and probably more than one now, that have created – essentially a universe of fake people, right? Like AI personalities that are designed to mirror the electorate. So they take census data, other third-party data, create this, and then they like, I'm using air quotes here, like poll that sample that is a fabricated representative sample, and they feed that sample social media inputs and stuff to try to make it mirror yeah. what's happening in the real world.
Yeah.
And last cycle, they were fairly accurate with mm-hmm. that, more so than some of the traditional polling yeah. models. And that was, and it's way cheaper, right? Plus, they can do essentially a national sample
yeah.
in like 20 minutes instead of 2 weeks. And so I was like, is this the future of polling, or is this going to get sideways and weird pretty quick? I don't know if you have any.
Well, again, insights. I'd say that this would be an example of opinion and sentiment analysis. It's a creation of a predictive model, right? And in a way, this is a new variant on old tools we've always played with in political science and sociology and political economy, which is we're taking a body of data that's associated with past behaviors. We're building a multivariate model. It could be a regression model or some other version of modeling, like a probabilistic regression or a probit or a logit or something akin to that. It could be a it could be a latent content analysis, a variety of things. And we are querying it and asking, okay, what do you think? And you get some parameters out of it. And then you can load information and scenarios into that, and you can generate outcomes, right? The one thing about information of the sort that you've talked about is it's so mountainous in terms of its volume that you can overwhelm a lot of the potential errors that exist in due to the ecological fallacy, mm-hmm. right? You can largely overwhelm any ecological fallacies built into the model through sheer volume and get some good parameters around your guess. Now, that's good so long as the past generally indicates towards the future, right? That's good so long as you know all the information that you've got in there about pickup truck driving, urban resident, libertarian, marijuana smoking voters tends to hold, okay? Mm-hmm. I know I just described myself, but that's okay. as long as that holds, you're good until things change, and maybe yeah. you don't pick up on that. So remember, Nate Silver was incredibly accurate with his models until he wasn't.
Right.
Right? And even then, he picked up on a sentiment shift in 2016, but he still was a low-probability shift. It was a 1 in 3 shift.
Right. But the 1 in 3 is not nothing. If yeah. I had a 1 in 3 shot at winning the lottery, I would definitely pay.
Yeah. You know? Well, yeah. Exactly. So I think there is a future there. But the question is it deterministic of?
Mm-hmm.
Or can it be defied by publics? And publics can defy these things, especially once they know that they exist, because human beings are inherently contrarian.
Right.
And no one more so than Americans.
Right.
And no one more so than Southern U.S. Yeah. residents, right. right? Most contrarian people in the world, right? So, I mean, we better have an SEC football control in this thing to make it function properly, okay? If I could refer you back to a story of what's scary about this, there's an old piece of science fiction from the 1950s called The Franchise.
Okay.
And it's a short story that was written by Isaac Asimov. And it's about voting, the franchise. And there's all this information coming into this household about the vote and the franchise. And what's happening is all these computers with these complex predictive models drawing on millions and millions and millions of bits of information about past elections and current environmental influences are trying to figure out where the median voter is in the United States.
Mm.
And what they do is when they've determined who that person is, a bunch of guys show up, scan his brain, feed that information into the UNIVAC, and it churns out the results for every election in the United States from the local level all the way up to president.
Mm-hmm.
And when bad choices are made, the name of the individual voter who's associated with that election just becomes mud.
Sure.
Okay. We're kind of talking about the same kind of thing. Oh, so there's sci-fi from 75 years ago that addresses a lot of these things. That's really fun.
That's so fascinating. My dad was a huge sci-fi reader. And so whenever I'd come to him with anything, I'd be like, Dad, does this sound crazy? He'd be like, just like you. Oh, no. That was in this book, Hyperion, blah, blah, blah. And he mm-hmm. would.
Yeah.
And so there was. I told Scott Melson recently, I was like, I think Democrats need to start reading some sci-fi to figure out how this story ends
yeah.
because they might learn a thing or two.
Yeah, they better read some Robert Heinlein in particular. They need to go read Starship Troopers because that's the one that's probably most on mark right
yeah.
now. We're in an environment that looks very Heinlein-ish.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's do you have a few more minutes to talk?
I got all the time in the world, Andy.
Great. Well, this will be a 7-hour podcast, friends. Take that, Joe Rogan.
No, I'm just kidding.
We've talked a lot about problems, right? And this all feels, I don't know, it feels heavy, it feels depressing, like, and it feels like there's nothing we can do about it because it's in Texas and California and Indiana, whatever. So let's talk about solutions. Because I think, I would argue that there are things that Oklahomans can do, or at least be aware of, that we can do to future-proof Oklahoma from being played the same way as other states. And there's stuff that voters across the country can do in their own states, maybe in Texas, maybe in California, maybe it's too late there, but in other places. And let's, we'll start briefly with what we've already discussed is independent redistricting commissions. So right now in Oklahoma and many other states, politicians get to draw their own districts. I haven't talked to any voter who feels like that's fair. Politicians love it for obvious reasons, but most voters are like, hang on, maybe that's not the way we should do it. And we've talked extensively on this show about the proposal that we used, which is similar to what Michigan has. Ohio proposed it. Oregon's working on it. It's a pretty good model. It's a little complex. And I've said it's a very simple problem with a complex solution because you're trying to future-proof and plan about how to avoid this commission being corrupted by those political influences. Now, in this current environment, the hard part for a lot of, I think, largely left-leaning states, like blue states, is that they might be the ones with commissions. And so this, even if the governor wanted to go in and gerrymander, they couldn't because they have to get the commission to draw it. And so I've seen this like a meme where, you know, Republicans say, like, we're going to gerrymander. And then Democrats say, well, we're going to gerrymander back. And then the voters say, hey, that's bad. And they're like, oh, well, we need your approval. And the voters are like, no, like, we don't like what they're doing, but we're not going to backslide on our progress just so you can do it back to them. Like, we're not playing this game. So anyway, independent commissions are one solution that cuts to the core of gerrymandering and to try to eliminate it or reduce it writ large. But you mentioned earlier single member districts. And I know we're going with this, but I bet our listeners don't. So please pick it up right there and let's go.
Since before the beginning of the Republic in the American colonies, we've been dedicated to the idea of geographic representation. That's how we elect people. We elect people from places. And those places have boundaries around them. Originally, they were counties. You draw a county, and then you'd elect some representatives from that county. And then they would go to Richmond, Virginia, and be part of the legislature. And Madison and Jefferson had this epic debate about how to apportion power among the counties in the state of Virginia based on who would be eligible and how you would use that as a basis to apportion power. I gave a lecture on it at OU about 10 years ago as part of the Freedom 101 series, which is still available up on YouTube. Kyle Harper, who was provost back then, put that together. But it's that's where we got the start of geographic representation, was that counties were subunits of the state. They were creatures of the state. They effectively implemented state law on a day-to-day basis, state authority. And you would send representatives from those communities. If a county got big enough that it had multiple representatives, it had also been divided into a series of wards, or what we used to call in the South beat districts, right, which were the beats that each county commissioner had to maintain roads and paths using the militia. So each beat would elect a commissioner to the county government. Each beat would elect a state lawmaker. And then we decided that maybe we need to have equal representation by population. That happened in 1962 and 63 through a series of lawsuits that come mainly out of Georgia, Alabama, and Texas. Okay. And I won't get into the details of those. But what happened is up until then, in Congress and in Congress till the end of the 19th century and in state legislatures till the 1960s, it was most common to use what were called multi-member districts. So you'd have, let's say you had a county and it had enough population to elect four representatives. The whole county would elect all four representatives. And in a state like Illinois, what would happen is you'd look down and you would vote for your top three picks. And invariably you get a partisan split and you get a couple of representatives from one party, a representative or two from the minority party. Everybody had some representation. And they'd go off and they'd legislate, and then they'd have re-election. In other counties, maybe what they did is they had what was called a post system. So each lawmaker was effectively running countywide for a separate, discrete post. Mm-hmm. That advantaged the majority party in the county. Mm-hmm. Okay, but all these solutions have one thing really going for them, which is it made it easy to draw constituencies. Okay, and it made it easy to translate votes into seats, but it also meant that a diversity of voices existed for any individual voter. And I think multi-member districts are great. It's just a question of what the vote mechanism to get them. Mm-hmm. Okay, Congress largely got rid of these, and they got rid of they initially got rid of multi-member districts, and then later on, statewide they got rid of multi-member districts in the late 19th century as part of a congressional apportionment mm-hmm. bill. Okay. So, for example, the state of Kentucky would divide itself into two multi-member districts and elect 10 members of Congress. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you get rid of that because individual lawmakers don't want to have competing voices about what they're doing at the Capitol.
Oh, because if they're running the same district, then they might have different visions for what that looks like and kind of conflict
there. And I need you to hear my truth, dear voter. My truth. My truth is the truth. Re-elect me. Send me back.
Yeah.
So that goes away in Congress. Statewide members of Congress have been used as late as the 1960s in New Mexico, Alabama, Texas, a few other places. Oklahoma had one, and his name was, oddly enough, in the 1930s, Will Rogers.
Oh, that's funny.
No relation.
Oh, okay. That's even funnier.
But he was the most fortunately named politician in Oklahoma history, mm-hmm. right? So you'd elect a member statewide. It was called either a flotarial district or an at-large district.
Right.
In 1962, Alabama had to reduce their number of congressmen by one. Mm-hmm. Instead of drawing districts and pairing up two lawmakers somewhere, they had the whole delegation run for re-election. Nine members running for eight seats. The top eight got a seat in Congress, and then they drew the districts around them.
Oh, that's funny. So wherever they happen to live, they just divided it up that way?
Yeah.
So there are some examples I can think of it locally in Oklahoma that essentially use multi-member districts. Like my sister ran for city council out in her town of Hera, right, just mm-hmm. east.
Yeah.
And they elect the mayor, and all the town council people are all elected at large.
Yeah.
But they each kind of represent maybe a geographic ward.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, well, everyone gets to vote on everybody.
Yeah.
That's essentially a multi-member district.
Well, you know, we have something akin to that in Oklahoma statewide.
What is it? The corporation?
The Supreme Court.
Oh.
Because we have residential districts for different members of the court.
Right.
And, of course, you know, that's, you know, you've got retention election, right?
Right. We don't put them there in the first place, but we vote to retain them.
So kiddies, young law students, if you want to be a Supreme Court justice in Oklahoma, live in Western Oklahoma, because that district has fewer members of the bar than any other Supreme Court district in the state. There are only about 375 lawyers out there. So your odds are pretty good that you can probably get a gubernatorial appointment to a vacancy when the time comes. There just aren't a lot of eligible candidates.
You've just got to game the numbers however you can.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, aside from multi-member districts, which would be another solution to get around this, and would there's some national groups I work with. Protect Democracy is mm-hmm. one that does a lot of this work. And then there's some others that are like there's a coalition in California called the Pro-Rep Coalition working on proportional representation out there.
When you and I got acquainted through Fair Vote.
Yeah, I was like Fair Vote too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea is you move to systems that are – and this is where I will kill my argument right here through my description. These are European solutions. There, that's the end of it. These will never happen except in Vermont and Maine.
Right.
Right. And in Port Chester, New York. Right.
Yeah. Cambridge.
Yeah. 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 So these are systems that work with, for example, party lists, mm-hmm. right? But or preference voting or single transferable vote. But the idea is that the whole idea behind these types of elections is there's information expressed by every voter. Mm-hmm. You think about this, kind of sounds like our AI, right? There's a little bit of information in every bit. Mm-hmm. And what happens is the best electoral systems that are the most reliable and the most valid will capture as much of that information as possible and translate it into the legislature somehow. Mm-hmm. And these list systems, proportional representation systems with what's called a minimal threshold for inclusion, mm-hmm. these solutions are surprisingly effective at creating stable governments, But also, it's very difficult to win a majority under these systems because they encourage third party and nonpartisan and splinter parties to run. Israel is probably the best worst example of this.
Right, and you get some like coalitional governments that have to form between multiple parties.
Yeah, and lo and behold, this means that parties and lawmakers have to work with each other and negotiate for power at an institutional level.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not a terrible thing to have lawmakers and decision makers engaging in negotiation, right? This, I mean, doesn't that sound like business to you, Andy?
It sounds like the way democracy was supposed to work when I learned about it in eighth grade.
Yeah, and this is where I'm going to make my pitch, which is I had a book come out 2 years ago called Democracy's Meanings that deals with what Americans think democracy is and how they think about it. And if you're really curious, because there are three essential definitions of democracy that can result in many other forms of it, go give that book a read.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's. I think it's even on Kindle now, University of Michigan Press.
Okay. We'll put a link to it in the show notes for this.
Awesome. And it's the better read is my football book, but this one will do. So.
Well, I'll put links to both just in case people are interested. I also plug another podcast that some of my colleagues have done. It's called The Future of Our Former Democracy. And the organization is called More Equitable Democracy, and they traveled to Northern Ireland, made a couple of trips, did a ton of interviews, got to witness some elections where they were telling me when the votes are cast at the polls close, they bring all the ballots into like the town center in one big room and just start dumping them out and everybody counts them together.
Yeah.
And I was like, what about security? They said, everyone's in there. Yeah. Like you can't steal them because everyone's involved. Yeah. And it's like a radical transparency process. Yeah. And I giggled. I was so tickled at the idea of this is like the democracy that we all wish we had.
Yeah.
And that is not at all how it happens here.
Well, the Irish part of my family is from down near Cork. Okay. Which is, the rebel county. It always picked the wrong side. But, the thing I love about the UK's democracy, is I love the way they do parliamentary elections. I love the way how they do the count. They announce the count that night. All the candidates are there and have a chance to speechify.
Yeah.
And it's great fun. And what it does is it reinforces the civic ownership of democracy, which is sorely lacking in the U.S. Government and elections and governing feel like something that's done to you. And we have to get away from that and get back to better things. And if you go to the Republic of Ireland, their elections are awesome because it's multi-party, multi-member districts, and they've got this high participation. You get this wonderful, wonderful diversity of representation coming in. And the Irish, I mean, I think the Irish have really figured this thing out on pretty much every dimension everywhere on the island. And I mean, if you ever been to Northern Ireland?
I haven't.
Okay, you got to go. I've been there a couple of times. One time I took a class up there for OU, and we were in Belfast, and we went to the wall, and we checked out the murals, and they have these things. They're called black cab tours. So the Hackney cabs will take you on a tour to see these things, and these guys are honest to God cabbies. And you'll figure out very quickly whether or not they are Republican or Unionist.
Okay.
But they will take you around and show you all this, and you get a fascinating history of the violence, resistance, and reconciliation in Ireland. And and boys and girls, it's only been 27 years since the Accords went through that brought peace to Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And one of our biggest fears with Brexit was whether or not there would be a border call in Ireland. And the truth is a Rule 50 border call is still a possibility. And it's probably in the best interest of the island. Because the Irish economy is stronger than the UK economy now. And that should tell us a lot.
How interesting.
Yeah. But again, our former democracy, it's funny because Kirby and Nick and I, we'd actually talked when we had finished our book. We finished it literally right before the January 6th insurgency. And I wrote up a new introduction of the book, which we used. And at that point, Kirby called me up and said, do you think we should change the name of the book to How Americans Thought About Democracy? And I said, yeah, it might not be a bad idea, Kirby. Let's see what the press thinks.
That's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us the name of the book again.
Okay, so that book is called Democracy's Meanings and University of Michigan Press. And I'll get you the link on that. But if you don't mind, the other book I mentioned is one that I just had come out, and it's called Bragging Rights.
Okay.
And it's about college football's national title descents. It's about any season where there's more than one claimant to the national title.
Oh, yes.
And there have been more of these than you think. Since 1936, 43% of national titles have more than one university claiming the national championship. Sometimes it's because the AP and the UP would disagree in the polls.
Right.
Sometimes they would both disagree with another title source called the Football Writers Association of America, which to me is the true Cadillac standard. But sometimes people also claim these little minor titles. The University of Central Florida claimed a thing called the Collie Matrix in 2017, even though Alabama won it on the field in the playoff by, you know, beating Georgia and Clemson on the way. And if you're here in Oklahoma, you remember that game well at the Rose Bowl between Georgia and OU. And then there are these things called retrospective titles. And Oklahoma State University has one of these. The Association of Football Coaches of America put out a call. They're the people behind the coaches poll.
Okay.
They put out a call for anyone who wanted to apply for a national title based upon having what was deemed to be a legitimate selector, and these were identified by the NCAA, that you should just basically send in your paperwork.
Right.
And they, if it was before 1950, and they give you a title. Only one institution has ever done this, and that's Oklahoma State University, which was Oklahoma A&M College in 1945.
Right.
They applied for it based upon a thing called the Nutshell Sports Blog Algorithm, which was one of 104 NCAA-recognized national title selectors. Usually all these algorithms agree with the polls, but this one doesn't. It says Oklahoma State
had the best. This is so wild already.
So it says Oklahoma State had the best football team in America, right? Here's the thing. OSU had a great team. It's the best football team they ever fielded. The national champion that year was a little known education institution called Army.
Oh, right.
And Army, West Point. Army was undefeated, played a very tough schedule. And they also beat Japan, Italy, and Germany.
Yeah.
They had a heck of a year, okay? So no one's buying the argument that Oklahoma State is a national champion over Army. And Barry Trammell dealt with this in a column years ago when it happened. But what we do in this book is it's the whole history of where the idea of a national championship came from in the early 20th century. A guy named Park Davis, who helped write the rules for football. He was a lawyer who had been a college football coach, helped write modern rules for college football. And then where the AP poll and the UPI poll came from, where the algorithms came from, controversies over time, information behind each controversy, and then rather than telling you who the title holder ought to be, it's up to you, the reader, the fan. This is about the bar argument. This is about the stuff we used to argue about in sports bars, or we like to argue about in sports bars or coffee shops. And so I spent about 6 years on Saturdays in the fall digging into this, and then it suddenly turned into a book manuscript, and then I had a couple of presses after it, and TCU Press made me the best deal.
Yeah.
And so it's available from TCU Press or on Amazon. It's called Bragging Rights, R-I-T-E-S, because it's about the ritual of bragging.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good title.
But it also engages – I'm sorry, Andy, go ahead.
No, I was I was going to say it makes me think of two different movies. One is that scene in Elf with Will Ferrell where he goes into the diner and he says, "Congratulations, you've done it. The world's best cup of coffee." And it's just like a shitty diner of coffee.
Yeah.
It's like, you did it. You're a world champion or a national champion. And it's not. It's like some obscure blog metric. And then also the movie Return to Me with Minnie Driver and David Duchovny.
Oh, I love Minnie Driver.
I do too. There's like the four guys are in the little restaurant. And there's a couple of scenes where they're just arguing about who was the best in the Rat Pack, right?
Yeah.
They're like Sinatra and Dean, like they're going through all of that.
Peter Lawford.
Yeah, right. It's what it sounds like, the same kind of thing of people arguing about who is the best when it is an unknowable thing by those metrics.
Which makes it fun.
Yeah.
It makes it fun. And that's why when I was working the book over, I was talking to friends and I said, I could model this, but I don't want to convince people of my model. Or rather, I don't want to convince people of a model. I want to convince people of the conversation. And so this is, hey, here's some evidence. Knock yourselves out. But what it allowed me to do is it set up a description and discussion of the creation of the BCS system, the creation of the four-team playoff system, and then the creation of the expanded playoff. And I finished up the book. I had time to revise it after the last playoff. So it's completely current.
Oh, that's cool.
And one of the things I pointed out is no matter what we do, we're going to have a controversy. And I go through all the controversies about the playoff. And I don't want to call the sports writers the villains because they're not. I love sports writers. But they perpetuate this stuff. They look for controversy where they can find it.
Well, it's their job to have the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what this book did is it walks you through it. And it basically, you know, I had been making this argument just colloquially, generally is, you know, if we go to an 18 playoff, we'll argue over who the eighth and ninth best teams in the country are, right? If we go to 12, we'll argue over 12 and 13. And what did we do? We forgot. Everybody forgot the first rule, the first commandment of SEC football, which is Alabama gets what they want. Okay? Alabama gets what they want and Notre Dame's special.
Right.
These are two things that need to end in college football. Notre Dame has not had a national title in 36 seasons.
No. Yeah. No, when the best two Notre Dame players that most of us can name are Rudy or President Jed Bartlett from the West Wing.
Well, don't forget Monte Teo and his invisible girlfriend.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so that's three, right?
Okay, there we go.
Yeah, but you know, and Rudy was offsides.
That's right.
And Han Solo shot first. Okay, right. There we go. Okay, real quick though, best Mini Driver movie.
Oh man, I honestly can only think of Return to Me. I know I've seen other stuff, but that's the only one that I can that comes to mind. Okay. But give me some other options that I'll happily pick. I'm gonna Google it while you're thinking.
Gross Point Blank.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's not the principal vehicle, but she is the star of that movie.
That's a great. I haven't seen that in, you know, 20 years.
Well, best sound. I'm from that reunion generation. I mean, this is. I wish my high school reunions had been half as good as Martin Blank's.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
She was also in Good Will Hunting, right?
Yeah, and again, just fabulous at it.
Yeah. I was talking about that movie with my wife the other day. I was like, I think I want to rewatch that. And she said, it was good once, but I think it would be really boring now. And she's probably right, but I still may spend some time this weekend rewatching that.
Yeah, the thing is, there's an endorsement deal somebody needs to do for her, and that's with Cooper Cars.
Oh, to be like a Mini Cooper.
The Mini Driver, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. You should send it. She's 55 years old. She's still, even by Hollywood standards, I think is like a prime target.
Yeah. Greatest cheekbones since Ingrid Bergman, okay? I was watching Casablanca the other night.
Oh,
it's just,
funny.
Yeah. Give me a great smile and I just melt.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Keith, thank you so much for being here today.
Good to be here, Andy.
Friends, my guest today was Dr. Keith Gaddy from Texas Christian University and, of course, our University of Oklahoma. Keith, you're going to come back, right? We're going to see you more regularly?
Maybe? Anytime. I still have some quarters I can draw in here in Oklahoma. I get back and forth. If I'm not in Texas, I'll wander up here. I wander around the country. But any given week, you just let me know when I'm here.
Well, you always have an open door here at the Democracy Den. Listeners, as you listen from home, we should be back here doing regular episodes every week. We'll do some regular, you know, weekly updates about the news. We'll talk about upcoming events and opportunities for you to get involved into crafting some of these solutions for our state, or if not crafting them, to make them a reality. So, as we say every week, decisions are made by those who show up. We hope you will. See you next week.